We need Iowans to remember who they were before they spoke English. I had just listened to this Meskwaki elder tell a 1,000-year history of his people and their movement across Canada to Iowa in first person. "We first lived in the land you now call Canada," he began. Note that first person "we," not the third person "they" of a storyteller retelling what he has been told or distancing himself from what happened, but "we." He was telling the story as if his feet walked the steps and he helped the early German settlers learn how to live in their new environment called Iowa. He and his wife had an expansive view of history, and I could have listened to their memories for hours. It was spring 2021, and I was attending a retreat offered by the Iowa Environmental Council. We were at the Marshall County Grimes Farm and Conservation Center near the Meskwaki settlement in Tama. All of us were feeling a little burned out by the challenges of a year upended by the COVID-19 pandemic, and we needed this gathering to help lift our spirits so we could better do our jobs. Our connection to the land that nurtured our ancestors turns out to be the bedrock that could elevate and revitalize our souls in times like this. To the Meskwaki elders, there was nothing that separated them from their history. This is Curious Planet, and I am Jacqueline Comito. Not long after that retreat, I was in my basement surrounded by soil and pots, planting pepper seeds given to me by my cousin Peter, who had inherited them from his mother, my Aunt Lou. Some of the seedlings would go in my own garden so I could continue to save the seeds, but more of them I would give to over a dozen family and friends and donate to a community garden in my hometown of Carroll. As I smelled the wet soil, I found myself pulled through a passage to my history, hearing echoes of the elders' words, "We need Iowans to remember who they were before they spoke English." March 7th, 1999, the basement of my Aunt Lou's house in West Des Moines.
So Aunt Lou, you could just as easily buy tomato plants, couldn't you? Rather than go to all this work?
No.
Why?
Why? Because it's cheaper and it's just a way of doing things we've always done.
How many years have you been doing this?
Like this? 37 years. I think before, when we lived on Pleasant Street, Charlie used to buy the plants. When we first moved out here, he bought the plants. I shouldn't say we've done it for 37 years. He used to buy the plants from some guy in Perry, Iowa. Then at one point, the guy used to plant them for him. And then at one point, Charlie would plant them and take them up there till we had, when we got the greenhouse, then he started doing it himself.
Was that both tomato and peppers?
Uh-huh, yeah.
How many years have you been doing the peppers where you save the seeds?
Oh gosh, ever since we've done them.
Why?
Well, in the first place, tomatoes we've never saved because you can't really save the seeds because they're better when you buy them. Pepper seeds we've always saved those. We started out, first of all, when my mother had those Italian peppers, we planted those. And then when Charlie started buying the hot bananas or the sweet peppers that we always grew, then he would just save those pepper seeds.
So the seeds you have here come from?
From our own plants.
So that's 30 years in the seed saving?
Uh-huh.
December 27th, 1994. interview with my mother, Joanne, at her kitchen table in Carroll, Iowa.
It was a very important part of her life, too. But she also had, when she died, and Monsignor Lyons was talking at church, he said that one of the things he remembered about Linger, and we were very close with Monsignor Lyons, was that she used to go to Mass a lot during the week, but we really never knew a whole lot about. But he said that he wasn't saying Mass, but she went to Eve early and she went out the side door into the cathedral, into that wooden courtyard thing, and she met him, and he must have said something to her. And she said, "I have some bread rising in the other hand, it is more important." And he said, she said, "I was kind of taken aback." He says, "But now that I think about it," he said, "I think she was right." And so she was. So she was religious, but to her, letting the bread get ruined would have been a bigger sin than this man. Her religion to her was a way of life in terms of how you treated other people. I don't think there was a prejudice bone in either one of their bodies. They're very tolerant, very believed in the innate goodness of their fellow man, treating everybody, rich, poor, alike. Gave away a lot of food to people if they were hungry.
Belsito, Italy, Thursday, April 3rd, 1987. A letter to my mother, written right after we returned to our hotel near Belsito, the village of her parents' birth. I was taking this trip through Italy with my father and two friends from the graduate program I was attending that year in England. I got out of the car, very curious, and somewhat excited. I wasn't even certain that this was right, or if these people were related to me. The man, from the city hall, said something to them. This tiny 4'8" woman, wearing a colorful scarf around her head, a black skirt and sweater, nylons, and black shoes, came out of the house. Her face was weathered drastically with such a warm, loving look. The man must have told her that I was the granddaughter of Giovanni Porco. Her face transformed as her lips curled into an amazed, genuine smile. She came to me and embraced me. She kissed me on both cheeks and then looked closely at my face. She ushered all of us into the house, made us sit down, and I was introduced to everyone there. They went to get a neighbor that spoke English. The woman, who I am told is your cousin Teresa, kept smiling lovingly at me. I was feeling a bit uneasy. I am still not sure that these are family except for one thing. Teresa had the most beautiful blue eyes. I felt like I was looking into my brother Stephen's eyes. Other than those eyes, I was afraid that I was in the wrong place. There was a lot of smiling, laughter, and a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. What if I'm in the wrong place? I would be embarrassed. After 20 minutes or so, the interpreter arrived. A whole new door of communication opened up for me. I asked him to see if they could remember when Papu John left for America. Teresa couldn't. Perhaps she wasn't born. She remembered that John sent them money and clothes and so forth, especially during World War II, and that they had a picture of her sister, a nun, who'd gone over to America to visit John. Teresa said that it was about 10 or so years ago. My grandfather had died in 1960. If the nun had gone over 10 or so years ago and they had a picture, then I am in the wrong place. I started to panic. I was ready to say, thanks for the coffee, I guess we were wrong, and goodbye. I asked the interpreter if they knew that John had changed his name. They all started to laugh. I heard the name Porco repeated a few times, and then lots of laughter. Our translator told us that John had tried to change his name before he left Italy. He went before the local judge to petition for the change. The judge refused, saying, your name is Pig, and Pig it shall remain. I guess it's obvious that Porco is pig in Italian. They seemed to jokingly resent the fact that John changed his name. It seemed more amused than angry. And now came time for the food. During the drive from the town hall to the house, my friends mentioned that we shouldn't eat there. I knew if they were my relatives, there would be no way we would be able to leave without eating. They set out the table and served a meal that I have been eating my whole life. Pork cooked in tomato sauce, capicola, cheese, wine, bread. Our interpreter let me know that everything had been grown, raised, and processed at the farm. The pig had been killed last October, and the wine is from their grapes. The cheese was made from goat milk. The food was good and spicy. Teresa brought out a canned eggplant salad that had been preserved in olive oil and seasonings. Teresa looked at me and said, "Mangia." I may have spelled it wrong, but I knew the word having heard it often as you encouraged us kids to eat. The food, more than anything else, made me feel at home, made me feel as if this was right. The bread was quite chewy. Teresa pointed to her teeth and said that they were strong. She looked at my teeth and said they too were strong. They brought out some pictures in search of the picture of Papu John and the nun. I was dreading the moment they found the picture. While we ate, Maria never sat down with us, nor Teresa. It was their job to serve the guests. Teresa stood by me and Maria sat by the fireplace. They found the picture and showed it to Dad. Dad hardly looked at it and declared absolutely that it was John. He handed the picture to me. I wouldn't know your father, but there in the picture was this short, skinny, very pretty woman who was a younger version of you, my mother. There was my mama in a picture in a small house in the mountain village of Belsito. Quite a thing to think about. I felt such a relief. I could relax and enjoy the meal. Boston Harbor, 1902. The young man followed the other passengers down the runway to a small wooden makeshift building. The people from steerage seemed to be organizing in groups, clutching suitcases and stuffed pillowcases. Husbands and wives, brothers, women with children. He looked at his small bag. He had no group. He was tired. It was difficult to sleep when there was no one who had your back. He quickly checked to see that his wallet was still in the spot in his jacket where his mother had sewn it. His mother. He refused to think of her. He hadn't let himself think of her the whole trip. It was too painful. As his stomach rumbled, he longed for a plate of pasta with fresh tomato sauce. Someone shoved him from behind to push him forward to the small building. Name. The officer looked up from the card he was poised to fill out. Kid, what's your name? Name? Ragazzo, come ti chiami? He kept his eyes on the marble floor of the courtroom in Cosenza. He had taken the train alone from Belsito that day, a 12-year-old traveler with one fervent intention. Porco, signor Presidente della Corte, Giovanni di Porco. The judge laughed deep within his belly, letting it slowly spill from his mouth to echo off the cement walls and magnify as the others added their chuckles to his. Giovanni felt the building shake with their amusement. The judge raised his hands to silence the bystanders. Holding the laughter, he looked at the disheveled urchin's tears. No, Giovanni, no cambio. Porco sei nato, porco sei, porco rimarai. Go, go, return to where you came and tend the pigs, vai. The laughter orchestrated itself to a forced crescendo. Giovanni left the room unnoticed by most, his dreams overpowered by the jocularity of the courtroom. The first guard stopped his exit and handed him a coin. There's a stand near the train station that has the best gelato in Calabria. You keep what you don't spend. Giovanni gave him a half smile. Grazie, signore. You are very nice. The guard rubbed the top of Giovanni's head a little dismissively. Fare un poco nell'acqua. You can't make holes in water. See? Giovanni took the coin and put it in his pocket. Si, signore. As he walked away, he touched the coin. No. There would be no ice cream for him that day. The American officer was still waiting for his answer. Without realizing it, he had taken the coin from his pocket. For the past year, it had been a talisman of sorts. No, no money, kid. I just need your name. What's the Italian? Nome. He looked at the coin in his hand and took a deep breath. He looked at the people behind him, pushing him onward. Porto, he said, turning back to the man. Giovanni Porto. Giovanni watched as the man wrote on the card and handed it to him. Take that to the next room and you are good to go, Mr. Porto. Giovanni looked at the card. Good to go. We need Iowans to remember who they were before they spoke English. I wish we could. I wish we had an oral tradition like I was hearing from the Meskwaki elders. In relocating from Calabria, my grandparents were unable to transport much in the way of material goods such as furniture, pots, and pans. They also seemed to have left behind most of their memories of family and a time before Iowa. It wasn't that they had forgotten, but they were allowing those memories to die with them. Instead, they transferred a wealth of cultural assumptions, mostly surrounding land stewardship and food acquisition, production, preparation, and consumption. While we didn't know that our grandfather had changed his name, or the way our grandmother's family collected mushrooms to earn their fare to America, those were stories I learned while living in Balsito. Many of us participated in cooking from family recipes or planting peppers. In fact, the importance of saving and sharing pepper seeds across generations was brought home to me at the recent funeral of Aunt Lou's son, Peter, the one who had given me the seeds years ago. After the funeral, another cousin shared with us Italian thin-skinned pepper seeds that came to him in 1960 from his grandfather. It is likely these seeds trace their genetic story back to Calabria. This winter, I will grow these seeds along with the hot banana pepper seeds from Peter and continue to be a part of sending this story into the future. I don't know the specifics of my story over the last several centuries, but I do know that within me is an inherited connection to the land that my ancestors gave me before they spoke English. While my mind does not remember the stories, my body knows the connection to Iowa and to Calabria, and so do the seeds.